I'm Mike Collins. The Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup is on the road this week. We'll be live from the HeroesCon Comic Book Convention at the Charlotte Convention Center. Grab your cape, your ray gun, your lightsaber, and stop by Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Today, my guest is presidential historian John Meacham, whose latest book is The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. It debuted at number one last month on the New York Times bestseller list, and it tells the story of how American leaders and citizens have overcome eras of bigotry, fear-mongering, and isolationism. More and more, Meacham looks like the natural heir to David McCullough as America's historian. His recent biographies of Presidents Andrew Jackson, Thomas Jefferson, and the elder George Bush each became bestsellers while also winning favorable reviews. Now on a national book tour, he joins us by phone. John Meacham, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thanks so much.
So let's start with what inspired your new book. The white nationalist protests in Charlottesville last summer, where counter-protester Heather Heyer died during a confrontation over removing a statue of Robert E. Lee, and President Trump then falsely equivocated that violence and hate existed, quote, on many sides. How did you go from your reaction to that to writing The Soul of America?
Well, what I was trying to figure out is whether there had been other moments in American history where a president seemed so morally out of sync with what appeared to me, anyway, to be the self-evident position that one could take. When you side with, even implicitly, with Klansmen and neo-Nazis, you're in a place where, to say the least, you don't want a president to be. And what led me to really try to go back and explore these other moments was an attempt to answer a question that I get all the time, I suspect you do too, which is, has it ever been like this? And the answer is yes, it has been. There have been moments of division. There have been contentious hours. There have been moments where racism and nativism and isolationism have felt prevalent and pressing. And so the mission here, for me anyway, was not to say, oh, we've been here before, so don't worry about it, but to say, we've been here before, let's figure out how we got out of those moments and apply those lessons today.
One of the things I think this book does really well is it puts so many of the current divisions into context, is some of which you just outlined. You explain the lost cause of states' rights, monuments I just referred to, obviously, in Charlottesville and elsewhere, as an assertion of, more than anything, racial superiority, or the misbelieved racial superiority, I should say, despite what you describe as, quote, implicit and explicit apartheid, end quote, coursing through American history, we remain far from a national consensus on what seem like straightforward topics to a lot of people. In your opinion, will that ever change?
No, because we're never going to be, I think, a 90% country about things. The nature of a republic, the nature of a democracy, is that we have divisions of opinion. And you may think that someone else's opinion is held in bad faith or is held based on false premises, whatever, but it's still an opinion. And as Jefferson said, divisions of opinion have convulsed free societies since Greece and Rome. So we will be in a perpetual state of convulsion. There's no doubt about that. The Civil War, the 1920s with the rise of the Klan, the Great Depression and its discontents, Joe McCarthy, early 1950s, the backlash against civil rights in the 50s and 60s. You know, these were remarkably difficult times where you really didn't have vast, vast majorities of the country wanting to do what we would think of as the right thing with the benefit of hindsight. And so I don't think we're ever going to reach a state of perfection. In fact, the Constitution, I'd argue, was written for just this kind of moment, for a kind of moment of unease where appetite and ambition and greed and selfishness seem to be playing an outsized role in the life of the republic. The document was composed to take into account that we were a sinful people, and that, as the Constitution says in the preamble, We're not seeking a perfect union. We're seeking a more perfect one.
Before we get too far into this book, I want to ask how far you had gotten into your planned biography of James and Dolly Madison before you decided to write The Soul of America.
I think I left off in 1791. I'd have to check the exact date, but right in there. And getting ready to go into that wonderful decade, fascinating decade of the 1790s, when it occurred to me that this was a moment where we needed some perspective. And I'm not pretending I have all the answers by any means, but I do think that history gives us a sense of proportion, a sense of at what point should we actually set our hair on fire, and at what point should we at least wait until this afternoon's tweet before we do that.
Well, so you were in 1791. Wait until you find out what the Canadians do at the White House in 1812.
It is the damnedest thing. I mean, to actually, we've only picked two fights with Canada in American history, one in 1812 and one in 2018. One of the fascinating things about this particular historical period is, you know, for somebody like me, it's Christmas every day. There's who would have thought the War of 1812 would be trending, you know?
Since I am speaking to a historian, let me just double check. Did the actual burning occur in 1812, or was it later in the War of 1812? Just to make sure I don't make a total fool of myself.
1814.
Yes, that's as soon as I said it, I had a feeling. I was like, it's not 1812, it's 1814. So there you go. I want to ask you a little bit. You were inspired by this fight in part over the Robert E. Lee Monument. I'm sure you're familiar with Bryan Stevenson, the visionary behind the National Lynching Memorial that just opened in Alabama. He says often that a significant problem in this country is a lack of memorials and markers telling the history of racial oppression in the United States. He says America remains much less vigilant about that than South Africa or Germany or Rwanda, in keeping its ugliest chapters of history alive. So I'm wondering what you think of his perspective on that.
You know, I admire Stevenson's work a great deal, and that's a fascinating point. By and large, the commemoration of the great American original sin of African-American slavery has been broadly limited to monuments to those who fought to end the constitutional experiment in the search for a more perfect union in the Confederate officers. So I think the work that's going on now in order to find a way for both sides, the complexity of history to be shown is a good thing. My own view about the Confederate monuments has always been that if you're in a place of public veneration on a piece of public property, the test has to be, were you devoted to the American experiment in seeking a more perfect union? And if you were, no matter what your sins were, Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, all slave owners, but you were committed to keeping the union alive, which eventually led us to the right place, that's perfectly fine. I'm much less enthusiastic about officers and officials of the Confederacy being on public land because they wanted to end the experiment. And I think what Stevenson has come up with here, if I may, is a very interesting and very productive way of being additive as opposed to subtractive. And I think that's important.
What's your confidence level that if people learn more through projects like Stevenson's, through things like your book, explaining how the Lost Cause narrative came about and persisted, that minds can be changed and hearts can be changed to some degree?
Oh, I think it's the most likely way. I think people would feel one of the benefits of history is that it feels calmer and, in a way, more relatable in an intellectual way than the present. because the president is coming at us all the time, right? It's tweets and cable news and headlines. And, it's just the maelstrom of the way we live now. History offers us a chance, for better or for worse sometimes, for contemplation. And if you take in a monument, if you read a book, if you tour a site, you might not immediately have some kind of illumination of heart and mind or change of heart and mind, but the seed is sown. And you don't have anybody pounding you over the head about it. It's not something you necessarily have to make a decision on right now. And therefore, it really plays, I would argue, to the great gift we've been given, which is reason, as opposed to passion. The present, more often than not, is about passion, not appetite. It's about solving things right now. History is more about, you know what, this happened, that happened, that's why. You know, so therefore, those are dots I should connect or not connect. History shouldn't be a narcotic. It shouldn't be cultural Zoloft. You know, it shouldn't excuse us from the battles of the present. But surely, at its best, it can inform the way we think about the battles of the present.
Again, we're speaking with John Meacham. His new book is called The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. I'm wondering, John, when you, of course, to your delight, you have your book debut at number one, but you go in any bookstore and it's essentially all politics, history, politics, obviously even print media is being dragged along to a limited degree of success right now. So does all that curiosity encourage you about the state of the American electorate?
Yes, I think that is a passionate moment. It's not a widely shared passion. That is, voter turnout is still woefully low for the people who should be voting. But it, unquestionably, I mean, one bright spot in the current climate is if you're for the president, boy, you are for him. And if you're against him, boy, are you against him. And so whether it's the midterms of 18 or the upcoming presidential election, there will be an enormous amount of activity, of social agitation, most of which we hope will be for the good. You know, we've seen out of the school shootings, out of tragedy come this new activism. We've seen out of the Trump movement, people who felt that the system had left them behind now feel that their man is in charge of the system, and so therefore they feel a new investment in it. A lot of people may say that's terrible, but from a clinical historical view, at least they're engaged. And you can't really be for engagement when people you approve of are engaged.
Good point.
And be against it when people with whom you disapprove are engaged. America doesn't work that way. You have to have an equal opportunity. You have to, you know, understand that the First Amendment is not just for people you agree with. It's also for people you disagree with.
Those are the words of John Meacham, the presidential historian. He is the author of the new book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. When we come back, we're going to have John weigh in on convention sites and where the GOP might be headed in 2020. I am Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and you are listening to Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Stay with us.
Have you ever wondered about the abandoned cars along Charlotte roads, or where your recycling goes, or who Tom Hunter is, and why is there a Lynx station named after him? Vote for the question you'd like us to answer in the next episode of the FAQ City Podcast by going to WFAE.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is John Meacham. He is the best-selling author of The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. And John, when we stepped away, you were talking a little bit about a renewed enthusiasm for political news and political debate, at least among some in our country. And I wanted to ask you a topic that's kind of top of mind here in Charlotte, North Carolina, which is Charlotte and Las Vegas are reported to be the only two cities that are finalists or maybe even desire to host the 2020 Republican National Convention. I'm not sure if you were here for the 2012 Democratic National Convention, but with all that buildup, what do you think the risks and rewards would be for a city hosting the GOP in 2020?
Oh, I think the rewards outweigh the risks. Convention cities are hugely important to the boosters and the debate beforehand, and then almost never important afterward. So as in point of fact, I was briefly at the convention in your city in 12. Sometimes they become shorthand for things. So I suppose one risk is if something, God forbid, terrible happened, it would become, well, we don't want another Charlotte, in the way people say we don't want another Chicago 1968. So there's that. But, political conventions actually are one of the more curious anachronisms in American politics that I can think of, which is to pull people together for 4 or 5 days when the result has been foreordained on every possible level. People say, well, it's a great television production. Well, that's true, but you don't need to go to a different city to do that, I understand why people want it. It's an economic boon. It puts you in sort of in the conversation. Sometimes it suggests that you're a state in play, an interesting state in play. And so so I wish you all the best.
Are any surprised that there seem to be a lot fewer interested cities this time around?
I hadn't thought much about it. I can imagine that people don't want, that they would worry about demonstrations and counter demonstrations, and that the possibility of becoming a cautionary tale would be higher in this era than they would have been even 7 or 8 years ago. I guess if I were a town leader somewhere, that would be what I would be thinking about. But there'll be a lot of money. It'll cost you a lot of money in infrastructure and police protection and all that. But at the same time, it's a noble tradition of having of being at the center of the political conversation in what will doubtless be a fascinating time.
Speaking of fascinating times, one thing that I really enjoyed about your new book is that you very clearly and cogently go through how flawed so many of, I guess all of our presidents have been, but the presidents who have made a difference, who have come up with courageous ideas, courageous speeches in times that have been uncertain and murky. One of the prime examples would be Harry Truman. You write about how he came from a largely racist background, how he misjudged the importance of Martin Luther King's March on Washington late in Harry Truman's life. But he's also the first president to address the NAACP. He also integrated the military. So if it's happened before, it could happen again, I think it is an obvious statement. But what's your confidence level that we will find other people like this in American political life in the near future?
Oh, my confidence in that such people will once again rise to the pinnacle is absolute, because they are human beings. They are subject to good days and bad days, vices and virtues. Unquestionably, that will be the story of the country. What's unclear right now is whether the incumbent has that capacity to transform himself, to grow in office. One of the things we know, I believe we know right now, is that the presidency has not changed Donald Trump. So the question becomes, has Donald Trump changed the presidency? And the second part we simply don't know yet. The Truman example, the Lyndon Johnson example, should both give us immense faith that people, even when they arrive at the pinnacle with lower than one would hope for expectations, that they can rise to the occasion. Truman, as you say, had a very checkered background on these things. But as president of the United States, he saw his duty whole. He received word about GIs coming back from World War II, African-Americans who were being lynched in the South. One was blinded by a policeman's billy stick, billy club in South Carolina. And Truman said, "My God, I had no idea it was as awful as that." And he insisted on arguing that we could not send Americans forth to fight against tyranny abroad and then endure tyranny at home. So he integrates the military, splits the Democratic Party quite starkly. As you say, he addresses the NAACP. He believed very much that he was the president of all the people. President Johnson was the same way, Lyndon Johnson. He had been a sectional senator from Texas. He came to the vice presidency. He began to grow there. Obviously, when he became president in the tragedy of Dallas, he became an unflinching champion of civil rights and forced through that legislation. Remarkable for a white Texas Democrat to have done that. But they understood that the presidency itself, as Lyndon Johnson once said, the presidency, nothing shines so bright a light on your conscience. Nothing opens up your soul as much as the presidency of the United States, because, as Johnson put it, no one's needs or hopes can be written off when you're in that office. And so some people might say I'm sounding sentimental, but these were the observations of the people who had the job amid the maelstrom of history. And I think one of the dispiriting things about the moment is that all of us wish, or people who are not thrilled with the way the president's handling his job, wish that he would begin to hear some of that music. And there's very little evidence that he has as yet.
Again, those are the words of John Meacham, who is the author of The Soul of America. One of the things that props up in your book several times is you point out that social media's disruption of politics is very similar to what's happened in the past when radio came in and then, of course, later with television, and particularly President John F. Kennedy. President Trump is both famously and infamously adept at using Twitter to speak directly to his supporters. I'm wondering how likely you think it is that social media will be, or maybe already is, a prerequisite for presidents to succeed going forward.
I do think that it's hard to imagine at this point a presidential successor of Trump's not having an authentic voice on whatever social media platform there is. I think if it appears as though it's coming from the staff, that's going to cost them at some level with the public. So I do think he's changed the institution in that way. The vernacular that he's really as much a part of, if not more so, than social media is the vernacular of reality TV. That's something that I think we don't quite appreciate as much as we should. I believe he understands the country, not as a country, but as an audience. He's worried about ratings. He's worried about keeping the tension up, the drama up. He loves cliffhangers. He loves changing the narrative. He loves saying, "We'll see what happens." He loves saying, "Stay tuned." You know, he understands the that part of the culture in the same way, as you alluded to, that Reagan and Kennedy understood television, that FDR understood radio, that Lincoln and Jefferson understood the written word. He's mastered the means of how a huge part of the country thinks and reacts. And in many ways, this is a presidency as reality TV production as much as it is a traditional presidency.
Let me ask you about a related media question, which is often when Donald Trump is mentioned, Fox News is mentioned, and people who support Donald Trump tend to like Fox News as much as they like the president, and vice versa. So I'm sure you saw last week Ralph Peters, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, who had spent the past decade as a military analyst on Fox and quit earlier this year. He told CNN's Anderson Cooper, quote, "With the rise of Donald Trump, Fox did become a destructive propaganda machine, and I don't do propaganda for anyone," end quote. I'm wondering whether you agree with that, and if so, how big of a problem is that?
Well, I should preface this by saying I don't watch a great deal of it. I do try to check in once or twice a week just to see what was happening in that part of the political universe. I think it is significant. I think that the willingness of an explicitly partisan media to unquestioningly accept the views of the administration without serious inquiry is a serious question, particularly given its role and relevance in the political, at least the political coverage. One of the things that worries me, and this is a broader point to some extent, is I do get concerned that there are now precincts on the right and on the left where it is almost impossible culturally to say something positive or negative about something the president has done, given the ideological predisposition of the network itself. And that worries me because it circumscribes our capacity to have an honest conversation about what's happening in the country. So it's almost as though it's we have tribal television now. One team is against him, one team is for him, and the facts don't matter. And I think that's a problem. It is also the case, however, going back to the historical point of view, that that's exactly what the country had as a media landscape for the majority of the life of the nation. That's the way newspapers worked in the 18th and 19th centuries. It's the way cable has gone back in the 21st century. We had a kind of exception that proved the rule with the rise of the New York Times without fear or favor, with the fairness doctrine on radio and television, as the electronic media became important in the middle of the century and a little bit beyond. But I do think that if people only watch one network and accept that as gospel, then that is going to only exacerbate the tribal tendencies that we're facing.
Well, you may have partially answered this next question, but I did want to flip it around. So obviously you are a frequent presence with Joe and Mika and the gang on Morning Joe on MSNBC. How do you think MSNBC's liberal left-leaning viewpoint affects the discourse?
I think it depends on what the broadcast is. I think it depends on where you're watching and when and what the mission of that program is or isn't. I would have no anxieties, whatever, saying exactly what I thought on Morning Joe and on a huge number of broadcasts there. And I think there's some opinion driven programming that is explicitly that. And I also think, frankly, that MSNBC is far more likely to entertain a contrary opinion than Fox is. So I'm totally comfortable with that association and the way that works. And I understand that there are a lot of people who would violently disagree with what I just said. that's all fine. You know, one of the things about this is you don't have to watch. You know, none of this is required to get a driver's license or anything. So thank God for self-government.
I think you had just earned your driver's license when you went to Newsweek years ago. And then from 2006 to 2010, you, of course, were the editor of Newsweek. You probably know as well as I do, if not better, all the things that have happened, the financial and ethical controversies, to put it mildly, in recent years. I'm just wondering, how much does that weigh on your mind, if at all, in terms of you haven't been there in many years, but it was a place that was near and dear to your heart. So what do you make of Newsweek?
Oh,
loved being there. I was there from, let's see, 1995 until 2010. And I've ever since the day I left, I've made a policy of not commenting on anything about the publication, just out of respect for those who have who've come along. I appreciate the question, but don't have anything to add.
Got it. Okay, and you're not going back anytime soon. It sounds like.
No, God, no.
No. I like to refer to myself as a recovering journalist.
Going back to James Madison and Dolly Madison, I wanted to ask you real quickly as we come up on another break, what is the game plan for your next book? Will that still be the next subject? And if so, how close or how far away from completion are you?
Oh, Lord. Well, as I said, it was about 1790, so we've got to wait. You know, the old boy lived forever, and she lived longer. She made it till 49. He made it till 36, 1836 and 1849. So I hope it'll just be a couple of years, but I've got a rendezvous with my my binders and my books for about 2 weeks from now, when I'm going to go back and have a better sense of it. The great thing about doing this kind of work, as you know, is it's something that David McCullough likes to say, is when it's really going well, you fall into its spell. And what you want, particularly with a big biography, with these kinds of characters playing out against the backdrop of these kinds of events, the founding of the Republic, the ratifying War of 1812, the struggles over the nature of the Union, you really want to be able to hear the music and smell the rooms. And so I'm looking forward to slipping back into the 18th and 19th century.
We're talking with John Meacham about his new book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. I am Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and you are listening to Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Stay with us. Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg, I'm in for Mike Collins, and we are speaking with John Meacham, the presidential historian, whose latest book is The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels, and it debuted last month when it was published at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. So, John, we've gotten through all of this without speaking of Russian collusion and Robert Mueller, so now is the time. I want to ask you, I can't let you go without addressing that. So,
I don't know. I'll jump in. I don't know a damn thing, and here's the thing. No one else does either. Bob Mueller is like a very well-coiffed iceberg. We see a little bit of it at top. We have no idea what's beneath the surface. I have a buddy at the New York Times who says that she, in 30 years of covering Washington, has never seen a more leak-proof operation than Mueller. So happy to speculate, but I'll tell you right now that nobody knows except the people inside that office what they've got and who they're going after.
Well, I just want to ask you this one aspect, and I agree with everything you said, just based from a distance, from what I read and see, there hasn't been. He seems to be 6 to 9 months ahead of the rest of us at all times, yep. If not more. But when the investigation began last year, when the special counsel was appointed, many people, historians, political analysts, warned against making comparisons with Watergate. And 13 months later, as you say, we don't have any idea where this is headed. But Robert Mueller has 17 indictments, 5 guilty pleas. He's just added witness tampering charges against Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort. So, but based on what we know now, how serious is this investigation? What I mean by that is, will it be relevant 20 or 25 years from now when people in your trade are looking back?
My bet is yes, that it will be. But it's just a wager. My sense is, as my friend Eugene Robinson likes to say, great Washington Post columnist, Gene says that basically Trump and Russia is as if Trump was pulled over by a policeman for speeding, and Trump behind the driver's seat says to the cop, "Officer, it's fine to write me a ticket, but whatever you do, don't look in the trunk." And that's basically what he's done at every point. Let me put it this way. If there's nothing to hide about his relationship with, broadly put, Russia, Russian figures, Russian oligarchs, Russian officials, then he has mismanaged to an epic degree the politics and the optics of this in a way that amounts to political malpractice. So if there's nothing there, he has just managed to, like Pigpen, or, you know, he has just managed to make a huge mess of something that didn't have to be, of which a mess did not have to be made. So I don't know. I think collusion, in a way, has been a gift to him, that word, because, A, people aren't really sure what it means.
that always comes in handy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, so that makes it sound as though, you know, it's like in Goodfellas, or you know, that they're sitting around, you know, in Trump Tower saying, okay, Vlad, you go into Iowa and Mikhail, you go into, you know, so it's created a kind of false, a high expectation of what this could be. My own bet is that it's probably at once simpler and more complex. There was probably never a meeting. You know, as I said, I was talking to a very high-ranking former Obama official not long after the inauguration, and I said, of Trump's inauguration, and I said, what do you think? Do you think there's anything to this Russia stuff? And this person said, absolutely. And I said, but wait, how does it work? I mean, if you're going to blackmail him, what do? Do you just call Trump Tower and make an appointment? And this person said, yeah, why not? Everybody else could. You know, I mean, so it's not, none of this is impossible. And the reason I'm sort of more candid about it than might seem discreet is every time the president has a chance to actually put this to bed, he doesn't. And then there's something else, as you say, some part of the Mueller iceberg pops up. And there's another indictment. There's something else. So it took, there were 26 months between the Watergate break-in and President Nixon's resignation. It took 4 years, almost 40, just over 48 months, for Joe McCarthy to rise and fall. Legal time moves more slowly than political time. And so I don't know. I mean, maybe this fades in the way, you know, other special prosecutors have faded. But there's just on a pure common sense level, God, it feels like there's something there. But I don't know what that is.
Yeah, you mentioned Watergate and the 26 months. And I think often when Watergate comes up, there is discussion about what the Republican leaders in Congress at that time were willing to put up with and weren't willing to put up with. And I know on Morning Joe, for example, you talk often about, you know, Bob Corker, Jeff Flake, John McCain, more recently, Trey Gowdy and Paul Ryan, to a much more limited degree, have sort of pushed back on President Trump and what they felt were some of his, you know, mm-hmm. bigger mistakes. But there's also a lot of concern about whether Republican leadership is willing to take on the president. Why do you think so few want to take him on? Is it because they agree with him, or is it because they fear the political fallout from taking him on?
I think at the moment it's fear. You know, in my state, for instance, in Tennessee, I think maybe I have this all, maybe this may be an old poll, but I think I'm right that 82% of Republicans support Trump in Tennessee. So if that's the case, and you're a United States senator, you're going to pick your fights pretty carefully. So I think there's anxiety about that. I also think, in a more positive sense, I think they're keeping their powder dry. And a lot of people, particularly NPR listeners, I suspect will their heads will explode when I say that, because they'll say, well, what more could they be waiting for? Well, what we've seen with Donald Trump is there's always something else. So it's actually a question that answers itself. I'm confident that a number of the senators I'm lucky enough to know or know slightly, they're going to throw themselves in front of the train, but it's probably going to be at the very last minute. One thing about the wonderful image, which I love, is that how the left has come to lionize Barry Goldwater. You know, if you wait long enough, anything will happen. Barry Goldwater went and told Nixon to resign. Okay, I hate to play self-parody role here, but let me tell you what actually happened. Hugh Scott of Pennsylvania, Barry Goldwater of Arizona, John Rhodes of Ohio go down to see Nixon to tell him there's not enough support in the Senate to stop conviction. Do you know what date that was?
I do not. Tell me.
August 7th, 1974. 26 months and 36 hours before he decides to resign. So this idea that Barry Goldwater stood up, you know, in the middle of Watergate and led a charge against Nixon is just wrong. They were, you know, George Herbert Walker Bush, a man whom I revere and respect, was the chairman of the Republican National Committee during Watergate. What second prize, by the way. And he didn't break with Nixon until the Supreme Court ruled in late July that Nixon had to turn over the tapes. The smoking gun tape of, what, June 23rd, 1972, where Nixon orders the cover-up, is leaked. That's when the bricks all came out of the wall. It was after the third week of July in 1974. Now, again, you have the tragedy of talking to, I'm the Forrest Gump of Watergate here. I'm insane. But I think it's important, and this goes exactly to the point of our conversation, I think that helps create a sense of proportion that, no, there aren't a number of United States senators standing up and saying that everything Donald Trump does means he's not commensurate or equal to the office. But that's not what United States senators tend to do. Some do. Margaret Chase Smith gave an early speech against Joe McCarthy and was proven right in the fullness of time. Jeff Flake, believe me, is going to be proven right in the fullness of time. John McCain is going to be, but as Jack Kennedy once said, there's a reason Profiles in Courage was only one volume. You know, there's not a lot floating around up there. And I'm being slightly flipped, but not really, because the point of the whole system is not that we send perfect guardians of the Republic to Washington and they do the right thing all the time. Politicians are far more often mirrors of who we are than they are molders. And so that actually should be invigorating to people. If you are active enough in your life as a citizen to stand up and change public opinion, I promise that in 7 out of 10 cases, I'm going to go low, we'll say 7 out of 10 cases, that congressman, that senator, that mayor, whatever it is going to take notice because their job is to take notice. And sometimes they're Edmund Burkean and sometimes they're, trying to, offer their opinions as opposed to their giving you what they want and all of that. But by and large, they follow public opinion. And so if you want to change what's going on, change public opinion.
You mentioned President George H.W. Bush, who you've not only written a biography of, but you've had a long-term friendship with. This weekend, I believe you're making an appearance in Charlottesville, Virginia, where you'll be interviewed by John Grisham. And when you eulogized former First Lady Barbara Bush in April, you shared a story about her reaction to a little bit of confusion between you and Mr. Grisham, but I'm going to let you take it from there.
Yeah, it's a totally true story. So a decade ago, I was on the National Book Festival on the Washington Mall, and I was on my way at that point to give my talk about Andrew Jackson. and a woman ran up to me, which doesn't happen enough, and said, "Oh my God, it's you." And I said, "Yes, it is. How are you?" She said, "Oh, I just love your book so much. Will you wait right here? I want you to sign your new book." And I said, "Yes, ma'am." And I was standing there thinking, this is exactly the way the world is supposed to be, right? Women are supposed to admire you. They're supposed to want you to sign your books. So that I was thinking, this is perfect. She comes back with John Grisham's latest novel. So she had thought I was Grisham. So I just signed it, you know, whatever. And the next day, that was a Saturday. The next day, I'm in May with the Bushes, and I tell this story. And Mrs. Bush looks across the table at me and says, and I'm kind of expecting some motherly reassurance, you know. She looks across the table and says, "Well, how do you think poor John Grisham would feel? You know, he's a very handsome man." And I was like, "Oh, you know, damn, you know." So it was a bad weekend for me, by and large. And so just to close that circle, I got an email from John the other day saying that he's worried about his fans because his wife had received a sympathy note because somebody had watched the funeral and thought I was eulogizing him. So it's a story that won't end.
In our closing minutes, do you mind sharing maybe a little bit of how you became close with the Bush family?
Sure. I went up, it's been 20 years ago this year, with my friend Michael Beschloss, the great historian. We were interviewing President Bush and General Scowcroft, his national security advisor, about a book they had written on their foreign policy. And it was a classic Bush experience. We showed up at 7 o'clock in the morning so we'd be out of there by 7:30. We ended up, I think we left at 6 p.m., you know, ended up on the boat, ended up, you know, having several meals. You know, the Oak Ridge boys were wandering around. It was just a totally insane classic scene up there. And as time passed, and I was at the magazine then, the president liked having somebody that, you know, if he wanted to send a message, he would occasionally grant interviews. And the more I got to know him, just the more I realized he was a much more complicated and interesting figure than I had appreciated. I was an undergraduate when he was president, mostly. And he had a presidential diary, and so we talked about it, and he ended up granting me total access to his diary. Mrs. Bush let me read her diary. He threw open the vault, and no right of review. The president read the book when it was published. It was just it's been a remarkable experience, and one for which I'm enormously grateful. And it was really the honor of a lifetime to be asked by Mrs. Bush to do that at her service. When she called 2 years ago and asked me to do it, and I said, "Well, ma'am, I suspect you'll bury me." And she said, "Well, that's the plan, but just in case, be ready."
I think that's as good a place to end as any. John Meacham, the author of The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's John Meacham. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. You've been listening to Charlotte Talks here on WFAE.